Welcome to Changemakers with me, Michael Heyman, and I'm here at the iconic London Stadium on the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, home of the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. The Games were simply unforgettable, a transformative moment for sport around the world and a feel-good moment of togetherness here in the UK. Well, to celebrate this legacy, I'm joined today by one of our most successful Paralympians, with 11 gold medals, 30 world records, and a legacy of advocacy that extends far beyond sport. Today's changemaker is the sporting legend, Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson. Tanny, welcome to Changemakers. What a pleasure to see you. And actually, in your own gaff, because here we are at the Olympic Stadium, a stadium you helped bring to London.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's slightly weird seeing it in football mode, but I was part of the bid from very early on. And then we won the games and I did a lot of work with the organising committee and then did 10 years on the legacy board, which was, you know, what happens to this? So this is one of the really cool things that came out of the games.
And you saw this when it was mud, when it was just a building site.
So we came on lots and lots of site visits. And there was one day that a whole bunch of us had come on a bus. And it was really muddy and it was tipping down with rain. It was disgusting. And Sebco was on the bus and he was like, everybody get out. And I was like, really? I'll just stay here. And he's like, come on, you need to get out. And mud and wheelchairs just don't work. And I'm like, So I tried to appear as if I was very gracious. I'm not sure I did. Got out. And then where I got out.
He's a hard taskmaster then.
it was worth it because I kind of, where I sort of sat, I kind of looked up. And then I realised there were the cones, which were the curve of the bend. And then I realised I was sitting right on what would be the 100 metres finish line. So
That's pretty cool.
It was actually worth it. And Seb just kind of went, see? Fair play.
Now we're speaking in the immediate aftermath of the Paris Olympics. And it was interesting. I mean, before we leave, you know, this sort of like an iconic stadium like this, I was reading something that you said about the kind of a stadium being almost like a goldfish bowl, unreal, that there was something, you know, that actually something so intense about it. I mean, pick up the story for us in terms of actually, here we are with a stadium with no people in it. What happens when you've got 60, 70, 80, 90,000 people in it, when you're an athlete looking up?
As an athlete, it's, you can almost feel the noise hitting you. So you leave the warm-up track, which is just athletes and coaches, and you're quite protected. You have different call procedures where you come into the stadium and you sit in the last bit for about 10, 15 minutes just in a room with your fellow competitors. Pretty cold, miserable, dark. And then you come out and you don't hear the noise until you're virtually out of the tunnel. And then it just hits you.
When it hits you, what's the feeling? Is it how does it sort of make you feel?
There's kind of a sense of pride there because you're competing for your country. You try not to let it stress you out. So if my family were there watching, I always used to like to know where they were sitting.
Right.
So that I wouldn't be looking for a flag or looking to see where they were. And that was always quite comforting to know where they were. And actually, if you in wheelchair racing, you compete multiple days. So my sister and family would always sit in the same seats. And then it's just the noise. And it's incredible how quickly it quietens down for the start. And then, especially if you're doing 400, 800, the flashes from drones goes off and it follows you around, especially if you're competing at night.
And what about when you're winning a medal? I mean, you know a thing or two about winning medals, 11 golds. You've got, I mean, you've just, and I hear you keep them in a rucksack. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Yeah. But anyway, let's come back to that in a minute. But in terms of that moment when you receive the pinnacle of sporting achievement and you've got the appreciation of tens of thousands of human beings, that must be pretty special, isn't it?
It's amazing because there's lots of different emotions to get to that point. So, you know, Athens, which was my last games, I completely messed up my 800 meter final, totally my fault, no one else's. Made a split second decision, which was the wrong one, but, and then you have to get yourself back together. And then I won the 100, which was my next race. So for me, I just burst into tears. So I don't actually look very happy, but I'm really happy. And then, you know, you get to do a lap of honour and, you know, then you wait for your medal ceremony. Again, you put back in a room with a banana and a bottle of water. That the medal ceremony is just incredible. Seeing the Union Jack, you know, we've got quite an iconic national anthem.
Yeah, like
people don't know the
words.
It's
a goodie, isn't it?
Yeah, but they know the tune. So you get a lot of people sort of humming along, you know, and then a lot of vicious people will sing. And then you kind of, they just chuck you out really quickly because they've got something else coming on. So next. And then you pick up your bags and you kind of queue for the bus, queue for your food, queue for the lift, and you're back to reality.
And you're there
quickly
with your medal. But I was just thinking, I mean, like your first medal was a bronze medal, and then you've just brought so many over the years. Mm. Well, you are one of the few people I've met that could genuinely fill a rucksack. I interviewed Duncan Goodhue, and he said, well, he kept his 1980 Moscow Olympics gold medal in a biscuit tin. I wondered, is that part of how you keep it real? Is that part of actually when you've done something which no other human being has achieved? Is there something that actually you've got to go home and actually you've got to wake up and you've got to be Tanny the mum, Tanny? I mean, or actually, is it just a convenient place to keep them?
No, I think it's quite complicated. So my parents had a huge influence on my life, but they were very much, you win or lose, you behave the same.
Yeah.
You know, you behave with sort of dignity.
Love that. You win or lose, you behave the same.
Yeah. Because either you're kind of really up or down. And that was instilled in me from being really young. Also, I don't need to see my medals on display for them to be part of my identity of who I am. And this came again very strongly with my parents, was that you're not just an athlete. Mm-hmm. So you're a Venn diagram, and an athlete might be the biggest thing that people see of you from the outside, but actually it's a big part of your life for a time, but you have to be something else.
You have to move on, yeah.
And so you come to a house, there's pretty much nothing out to show that we're an athlete. My medals never come out. I don't show people, you know, I'm not there kind of foisting them on people.
The fact that they are yours, the fact that they are earned as well, the fact that actually... It's funny, when I think about you, I think of Dame Tanny Grey Thompson. That it's almost like ingrained in my mind, because when I think about British winners, that's a name that comes up, right? You know, so obviously you've moved on to become a crossbench peer. We'll talk about that. But in terms of your achievements, I mean, these are part of, I suppose, the recognition that you've received and earned. And I suppose, but they don't seem to feature as something that you feel... you necessarily have to identify with day in, day out.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to lose them.
Yeah.
But for me, it was winning the race that was really important. Mm. The medal is the tangible bit for other people. So, you know, they occasionally come out to schools.
Yeah.
You've got to be more than the athlete.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, because actually you're a long time retired as well. So I think if you only define yourself by... You know, my Paralympic career on the track's 19 and a half minutes of my life to win those medals.
Yeah.
If you define yourself by 19 and a half minutes, then it's actually really hard to transition out and get a, you know, perspective. It's hard to have a perspective on your life when you're competing, if that's all you think about.
I'm going to move on from the medals, but having done a number of interviews with sporting sort of, I suppose, legends. I mean, I've interviewed people like Jess Ennis, and I mentioned Duncan Goodhue. I mean, I interviewed him on stage, and he pulled the medal out in front of 3,000 young entrepreneurs. Yeah. It was incredible. It was off the chart, the response, in terms of what it meant to the people that were looking at this incredible achievement. And I suppose it's the sort of thing is like, it's almost like you lose the words to explain about actually how much it means to us, the viewer, your fans, that you've achieved those things.
I mean, it's great. I do, you know, take them to schools.
Yeah.
And I think that the tangible bit for my parents, for the, you know, it's because I've visited a lot of schools over the years, and people remember different things. They might mention, you know, talking about a race or other things. But I think it's what I find it really weird, because I end up spending time talking about my life in the past and what I used to do. But I'm a forward-looking person.
Yeah.
So I don't sort of wake up every day thinking, oh, I was a Paralympian. I wake up thinking, right, what have I got to do today? And look forward.
I mean, before we lose the celebration, I mean, you've just been in Paris. You've been with the British Paralympian team. Mm. I'd imagine some pretty big celebrations. I mean, coming second in the world. I mean, what an achievement.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. You know, I think we probably expected France and USA to maybe win some more medals. But that's what, you never know who's going to win, who's going to do what. But, you know, China are impossible to beat. You know, they've got 80 plus million disabled people.
Yeah.
So their talent pool's huge. But I think it just shows a lot of, you know, where British sport is. And, you know, there's investment into it, obviously. But there's a huge pride in competing for GB.
I mean, tell us about that journey, because, I mean, in the 80s, you were paying your own way. Mm. You were, you know, this was not the professionalized, supported sport that it is today. I mean, give us a sense of that journey and in terms of, I suppose, what you see. I mean, it's interesting. I've heard you say that actually back when you were paying your own way, that there was a sense of equality with that, that actually it was kind of like something that you felt alongside both Paralympians and Olympians in that respect. Give us a sense of that journey and where we are today.
So, I mean, early on, nobody had any money. Mm. So, and lottery funding's been amazing. But then it does end up being, you know, some have access to that funding and some don't. So there can be some divides that develop. But, you know, when I was earning money to go and spend 6 weeks racing in the States, you made really sure that you got value for, you know, for money for what you're doing. So I remember, you know, at the end of every season, my dad used to say to me, right, you haven't got a pension because you've spent it all. And what are you going to do when you grow up? Mm. And massively supportive of my career. But it was that kind of tone as well. So you kind of had to deliver because it was on me. And so I was very lucky growing up in Wales. We have our own media, you know, sponsors. I you know, had support from being, you know, mid-20s, which other Paralympians didn't have. And also, I think the rise of my career coincided with Wales not being terribly good at rugby.
Yeah, but
which helped.
1990s helped your career, but not Wales's sporting achievements. But you were very much the Welsh superstar in that. But contrast that then to today. I mean, give a sense for viewers about actually the Paralympian scene. I mean, obviously, we see it in terms of, I suppose, the end result, the medals. But actually, what's the story about the sporting scene today in terms of actually what goes on behind the scenes?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the funding that the athletes have absolutely makes a difference. I think the biggest difference it makes is actually having things like physiotherapy and rehab and that sort of stuff funded and supported. And, you know, if I look back, we had a, you know, a really rich competition program. You know, we used to start in January in Australia, Florida, February, LA, March, you know, all over the world. So some of that's gone on. I think what's happened is there's more media coverage. There's sometimes an assumption that what happened in the 90s wasn't very good and it only became professionalised when money came into it.
Yeah.
But we also had, you know, a significant number of coaches who did it in their spare time, who in the real world were in really high-level jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there was a lot of professionalism, you know, with a small P.
Right.
They just weren't being paid.
You said in about London 2012, you said as much as 2012 was amazing, it didn't change the world for disabled people. Did Paris 24 change?
No. I think with 2012, a lot of non-disabled people like to think that, I mean, the games were stunning, but everything was fixed and it's okay. And we don't have to worry about disability anymore.
It was a good PR message.
Yeah, and that didn't come from the organising committee or the Paralympics. That came from, you know, people who live in the real world who had a sense of injustice about the way disabled people are treated and just wanted it to be okay. But it didn't change how many disabled people are employed. IPC, International Paralympic Committee, have said since Tokyo, there's been an extra 1 million disabled people employed in the world. Mm. It's not a lot, really.
No, it's not a lot. But what should we expect something like an Olympics to help deliver it? I'm thinking in terms of societal understanding, in terms of change. I mean, Channel 4 have just said this morning, actually, that they've reported they had 20 million viewers, one of their greatest ever viewing achievements as a channel. Does that help move the needle? What else is needed to go alongside it, I guess?
It kind of just shines a light, but it shines a light on 215 disabled people who did really well at a games. So we don't expect the Olympics to change the world. Mm. We, you know, there is an Olympic truce where countries aren't meant to be at war with each other during the games. You know, that's kind of ignored mostly. But we have this massive expectation of the Paralympics. So it can open doors, it can start conversations, it can get people to go, oh, hang on a minute. But it doesn't change legislation.
Does it change understanding? Because are we now seeing the Paralympics as great demonstrations of elite sports in a way that perhaps in 2012 we were much more focused on the stories, we were talking off air about the stories that go behind it, that everybody assumes there's a certain backstory to a Paralympian that maybe they don't expect with an Olympian.
I think the number of people who understand it, it's elite sport has widened. So, you know, in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, you know, there was still really good sport. I think there's a few people who like to think that, you know, 2012 was the start of the Paralympic movement, where, you know, each Games was an evolution in different ways. And there's not been that steady climb. There's, you know, been bumps in the road. But I think, you know, if you look to France, you know, they promised to make the metro accessible. They didn't. At the closing ceremony, there's been a commitment to do it in the next 20 years. So based on what we know from the UK, that's going to be 40 plus years.
Mm.
But it can move some things along. But it can't.
But it's limited. But yeah. But I suppose that then sort of brings us on neatly in terms of actually your role as a campaigner, especially around disability. I mean, you know, it's a big story at the moment, Tanny, that, you know, you had, in your own words, that you had to drag yourself off a train in a major capital city, London, at King's Cross. You know, it feels like there is still so far to go. I mean, you talked about feeling angry, rightly so. just evoke that feeling for us about what it felt and actually what happened.
Yeah, so I was coming down from Leeds to London. I'd booked assistance, which you don't have to do. And I knew I was going to miss the train, so I cancelled that, turned up at the station, asked, could I get on a train to London? I was told which train I could go on, which happened to be the next one. And then when I got to King's Cross, there was no one there to meet me. The train was quiet. You know, usually that time of night, there's a lot more people around. You know, it was bank holiday. The platforms were pretty much deserted. It's not the first time it's happened. You know, I'd had problems getting off a train in Newcastle a couple of weeks before. And then actually a young lad saw me on the train, ran off and got help and held the doors open until they came and got me. So, and bizarrely, day after I came back, I got left on another train. I just didn't post on social media about it. My sense of frustration, I have more privilege than any other disabled person I know. And, you know, there are so many people who don't have my platform, who can't shout, who can't get out of the chair and crawl off the train.
So is the anger for them as well? I mean, right.
Because I could like that make my life really easy.
Mm-hmm.
I could take the mobile number of any of the chief execs of any train company and I could ring up them any time of day or night and get on and off the train. I won't do that.
And I suppose with two equally understandable responses being determined or deflated in terms of how you feel about a situation like that, in terms of actually it spotlighting in a very vivid way just how far of a road there is still to travel. How do you feel about that? How does it make the campaigner respond?
So I was kind of angry on a personal level because having to sit on the floor of a train is pretty grim.
Yeah.
Actually, I had a load of washing to do to get onto the train the next day to go to Paris. So it's like, seriously, I'm not going to get any sleep.
Practical.
Is it?
Yeah,
a very practical bit that a lot of non-disabled people just don't have any concept of how much longer you've got to get to the station, how long it takes you to get out, all the extra travelling time. And then a massive part of it was angry for all the other people I know who experience this day in, day out, who don't have the platform I did. So there's this a bit of a sliding doors moment that it happened to happen when it did, you know, on the eve of me going out to Paris. The time of night. So I was very angry tweeting as the Radio 4 Today overnight team came in.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story that has captured the public's attention and I think imagination. And I suppose quite often change makers have a moment. There is a tinderbox moment where something happens. There's a level of consciousness. I mean, does the world just go back to the same old, or do you sense an opportunity as a campaigner to sort of make more progress?
There's sort of these baby steps, and you know, I've been posting on social media for years about trains, not because I think that's the way to complain to the train company, because I don't think it is, but to educate people to say, hang on a minute. You know, so lots and lots of other times I've been stuck on a train, I've had people say, oh, you post about trains. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an education thing, you know, and then, okay, this is quite a surreal moment where my husband will tell me off name dropping. Kelly Holmes, who I know really well for years, she'd been on a train, saw a wheelchair user that couldn't get off. And so she was like, this happens to Tani, right? And she just corralled people to sort it out as a few years ago. Mm. So, you know, sadly not everyone has Kel, you know, there to kind of just make it happen. But, you know, it kind of spreads.
Yeah.
So, you know, the train I was left on the other day, you know, as I was getting off, four or five people said to me, sorry, it happened. Mm. So if you can nudge those things, so that's the bit. So, you know, what I said, you know, and this is for any, you know, prime minister, president, minister who was at Paris, and there were a lot of them. You know, if you were upset, angry, annoyed in the moment, or just fed up of me talking about trains, you know, and you talk about being inspired by the games, come back and do something. And it's not just trains, it's employment, it's education, it's pee in schools.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So this is, you know, on one level, there's a story here about utility. Let's just make it work for everyone.
Yeah.
But there's also a big story here about equality, isn't there, in terms of actually how you are treated and what you have every right to expect. And obviously, you've gone on from sport into politics as a crossbencher in the House of Lords. I mean, it's interesting to think about that journey in terms of actually Tani, the campaigner for equality, and actually what took you from sport into that kind of frontline political role?
So my plan, whenever I got to the end of my sports career, if I ever thought I could have one, would be to do law conversion, become a lawyer. Because I could walk when I was young, I started off in mainstream primary school. Then it was a massive fight to get me into mainstream high school.
Did that experience leave you with a strong sense of social justice?
Yes, because just because I was a wheelchair user, I was deemed not suitable to go to mainstream.
Right.
And the special school that the education authority wanted to send me to, you could do a couple of CSEs, you know, which weren't any use if you were going to get a job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dad sat me down when I was about seven, and he was an architect. So he had a book and had pictures of Sydney Opera House, Taj Mahal. And he gave me this big story about the world's an amazing place. And you need to travel to do that. You need to get a good job to do that. You need a good education. So all this stuff was there. And my parents were well educated, and you know, my dad had a good job.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of protection growing up from stuff. And then, you know, my parents looked at the school that I was meant to go to and was like, you're not going there. So they found the work of Mary Warnock, Baroness Warnock, and threatened to sue the Secretary of State for Wales over my right to go to mainstream school. So
yeah, that's a punchy move,
yeah,
right?
I mean, you know, a lot of parents wouldn't do that. And I remember my dad giving me white and green papers and telling me when I was 10. And said, you need to read this, you know. And then there's this moment. So I actually went to Loughborough University because Seb had gone there. Not much more complicated than that.
Good sports department, good politics department, which you studied.
So I did politics.
Yeah.
And so I was always interested in politics change. And my dad, again, from being really young, was saying to me, you have a lot of privilege. So don't just take it for yourself.
Well, I'm going to stick vicariously with family. But one word I heard said was that if you want to get Tani Grey Thompson in one word, it's wisdom. Wisdom was the word that I heard. And so I wondered if you could help me with aim high even if you hit a cabbage. Is that point of wisdom?
Oh, do you know what? Like, we have no idea where it comes from. So my mum's dad, my granddad, used to say this to me.
It's a great one.
I mean, it's like literally no one else has heard of it. And yeah, from me being about 6 or 7 years old, and he died when I was young. And that just stuck with me as something just quite cool. And
it's a great symmetry, isn't it?
But it's that resilience. It's about give it a go. And so I guess it's a lot of what my parents gave me is like, don't be afraid to try. Even though, I mean, every race I did, I used to get really nervous and like throw up. Luckily, I don't do that in the chamber. And it's about, no, you know, there is no overnight success.
I was interested that your mum was always interested, had you won, and your dad was whether you'd done your best as a son. But it'd be quite interesting to delve into actually that, I suppose, that kind of parental influence.
But they're really important things in sport. Yeah. So it comes back to that sort of bit of humility and the other things is that winning's binary and the medal table's binary, and that's okay. But my dad would be, you know, if I came 10th and raced well, there was nothing else I could have done. Right. And if I'd won a race and I was like, oh, well, he'd be like, well, you should have tried harder. There's one sports commentator my mother very strongly dislikes. I've no idea what he'd done. But then he said something nice about me. And immediately he became the most incisive, brilliant sports commentator that ever existed.
Yeah.
So that was my mum. And then my dad, you know, was
that's
just,
a good mum.
Was very calm and, you know, very sort of balanced about it. So again, it's all these things that, and you know, my first set of coaches were very much like that, you know, work hard, try your best, you know, just, you know, learn from the stuff, be better next time. Mm. Everything you do, be better next time.
Family obviously has a major impact on you and your life. And I mean, let's just go a bit more into that, because I mean, obviously at 5 to 6 years old, you discovered you had spina bifida. I think I was reading somewhere where you made the point that if you'd been born a generation earlier, you might not even be here. And but as you had parents that were with you, grew with you, determined to make a life for you, and did an amazing job of that, presumably.
Yeah, so when I was born, they knew I had spina bifida, but they had no idea how it was going to impact me. And apparently the only question my mum asked was, could I have children? Nothing else. But again, you know, both my parents were only children. My dad had been quite ill when he was young and wrapped in cotton wool. My mum's parents were much older when they had her. So, and they kind of joked between them, they weren't very good at having children. So my sister was born with a heart condition and dislocated hips, which all got sorted out. And then I was born with spina bifida. And so they were just like, okay, let's get on with it. Very, you know, mum was very much in her, what she would say, I didn't have any time to sit around crying because I just had to get on with it. But that was her personality as well.
But wrapped in cotton buds was not your life, was it? I mean in many ways they confronted you with the reality of the world that you were growing up, that there was a you know, there was a strong message that was delivered, I guess.
Yeah, but also, I mean, I experienced loads of discrimination growing up. So, you know, being five or so and being stopped in the street and being asked why my parents hadn't terminated me. And then me having to say to mum, what's termination? But mum was very much, if she saw or, you know, experienced people being horrible to me, she'd be like, right, they're an idiot. Don't let them bother you, you know, because they're an idiot. And you go, oh, okay. So, I mean, if my family had said that to me, I'd have been really upset. But that's the resilience, which then helped me when I was in
school. And I suppose it's the nature-nurture point, isn't it? Because as well as being a winner, I would say another word that people will say about you is determined, that you are a determined character.
Awkward.
However,
that's another version of it.
Well, that's the companion. But you're a person that is determined to see things through. And I suppose just in terms of that early experience, I'm sort of thinking, you know, obviously there's a sporting story, there's an advocacy story, but there is this family story, which feels like it's very important to you in terms of your upbringing. But then now as a mum, as a person that obviously has family at the heart of everything they do.
Yeah, my family are huge and I'm very close to my family. You know, without them, I wouldn't have done any of the things I've done. You know, my husband's changed his career a couple of times for me. You know, when we had Karis, me then to go carry on competing. And then, you know, when I went into politics. So they've, you know, just been there through all the ups and
downs. Is it a team? Does team as a metaphor work?
Yeah, it would. Yeah. I probably never really thought of it in that way. But my mum used to have a phrase. So she used to say that we were reeds that blew in the wind, that acquiesced to everyone's wishes but our own, which is so far from the truth. But that kind of resilience stuff just matters. And so I get asked a lot, what do you think you would have done if you were non-disabled? I was like, I don't know. But the personality that I am would still have been there.
Yeah.
I just would have.
Because, you are who you are.
Well, because my mum, my sister, me, my daughter, you know, it's all there. So the one bit I do get very passionate about is protecting my daughter. You know, because I was never once asked, was I going to be an architect, which my dad was. She was asked all the time, was she going to be an athlete or is she going to be an Olympian or is she going to... And then she also gets a bit of grief because of my political career.
Well, because the political side, obviously, you get a different response than when you're a sports star. And of course, you know, I mean, one of the most depressing... parts of the story of the King's Cross the King's Cross train story you were talking about is actually the social media trolling that you actually had to experience. I mean, that must be just hugely upsetting, isn't it?
Yeah, there were a couple of emails and some posts that were really horrible. But there's a bit in, when you've been in politics, you know, for a while, then you get a reasonable amount of you know who do you think you are, sort of thing. You know, not great language.
What drives that? Is it just because you're part of this general bubble now of mistrust in anything to do with political authority?
Yeah.
Or to what degree does disability come into this, do you think?
I think there's distrust. I think people are very angry. I think if you're in the public eye and are, you know, you can find our email addresses, or you just write Tanny, House Lords, it'll get to me. That's not encouraging anyone to do it. But people want to chat. And, you know, there are some people who have very complicated lives. So you have to try and put yourself through the lens of their experience as well, that they might be shouting at me because it's just they need to shout at somebody. Some of it was really quite abusive, which is, you know, who the hell do you think you are? You shouldn't be out at that time of night on your own. You should pay for a carer. You know, you should be at home. And some of it. And then the really sad bit is that being in politics as long as I have, you get a really quick sense of whether it's reportable to the police or not.
Mm.
And one of them didn't quite reach that threshold, but was really, really very offensive.
And yet, you seem to me to be a very positive human being with a great sense of resilience as part of it. I mean, let's talk about the political side. I once heard politics described as a good sickness, that actually it was one of those things that you couldn't quite explain why you did it, but you did it nonetheless. I mean, is that how you relate to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, sport and politics are really similar.
You know, interesting. Why is that?
The resilience you need.
Right.
You've got to have kind of a level of ego to keep putting yourself in that position. You keep putting yourself on the start line, you know, whether you're doing well or not, you know, you keep putting yourself in the chamber. You spend a lot of time doing really boring stuff.
Yeah.
Training's boring. Reading briefing papers is not exciting. But then in the chamber, you've got 3 minutes to make a speech that will take people with you.
Mm.
Or they still think you're an idiot. So, as an athlete, you're constantly looking for other people's views.
Is it more stressful than elite athletics? But I mean, what's it like making a speech in the chamber or what?
Your maiden speech is horrendous.
Right.
Absolutely horrendous. But then everyone's so nice. So you got all these like handwritten letters saying it was brilliant. It was the best maiden speech they've ever heard. And, you know, welcome to the chamber. And then you realise they do that for everybody because otherwise you'd run a mile and not come back. So, you know,
are you your own biggest critic, do you think?
Yeah, I'm pretty hard on myself.
Right.
But that makes me better, I think. Yeah. So, you know, if I did a race, we'd review it. Same way, win or lose, you review the race. When I make a speech, I then sort of think, okay, could I have said that differently? Could I have said it better? What would I do next time? You know, I spend a lot of time, you know, when I know debates are coming up, you know, sort of rehearsing, thinking, if I say this, what, you know, kind of trying to plan a route map.
Yeah. Well, I suppose because as an elite athlete, you can't afford a bad moment, right? You know, because if you're out and you're racing, and you've got to somehow make that worst moment your best moment, that carries through to when you're making a speech, I guess, and being a public figure.
Yeah, and I guess the one thing, you know, in politics, until we get reformed, there will be another opportunity, but you don't know whether it's going to be next year or in 10 years or when that. So you've got to be quite creative as well in terms of trying to find opportunities
right.
to get your point across.
Did you find going into an environment like the House of Lords that you got the empowerment to affect change that you'd hoped for? Or is it a more humbling experience than that, perhaps?
I think because I've been around politics, and so even when I was competing, I did a lot of other stuff around the edges. You kind of have a sense of it's not going to be easy, that, you know, you have to have that resilience. You have to just keep going. You have to build coalitions. You have to try and kind of connect to everybody, because I don't have a party behind me to vote with me. So, you know, I guess the funniest thing I find out about the Lords is that there are people who I fundamentally disagree with them on something, but then you can be completely agree with them on something else.
Right.
And that's a bit weird. So I remember there was one vote and I kind of went through the lobby and it was like, really?
Yeah.
Like, I agree with you lot. Right. Okay. And so some of that's quite, and then you find with, you know, connections, you just don't talk about necessarily the things you disagree with, but
right.
there's quite a reasonable amount of camaraderie.
Do you bring that campaigning start? I mean, obviously the House of Lords, ancient institution, it's about to be reformed. I mean, do you approach the Lords as a kind of agitator ready for change, or actually do you, once you're in it, do you start to think, oh, actually I'm not so sure I want to see it changed?
I think my view of it's changed. So I think before I went there, it was like, I don't get hereditaries being here. But now hereditaries bring value, you know, the diversity of thought of the chamber, and it's not as diverse as it needs to be. We get criticised for our average age, you know, for lots of things. The challenge with that is every year we're there, we keep the average age up. So, you know, I went there at 39 and, you know, I was considered young. I mean, we've now got people in the late 20s going there. But it's about having different opinions, and it's a place that you can express an opinion, because however abhorrent somebody's opinion in the chamber might be, there's people outside who think that.
Does that mean you've learned more about yourself in the world of politics than the world of sport?
Yeah, I think so, because I think it's made me be more fluid in terms of thinking, okay, right, do I think this? What am I able to compromise on? And there are some things that you have to compromise on. It's like, okay, can I get that through? I really want that to get through, but I can only get that far, so I'll take that. And that's probably been the biggest thing that I've learned.
And in terms of how it leaves you sort of seeing yourself, I mean, obviously, a lot of us know you through the world of sports. Do you view yourself as a sports person, or do you view yourself now as a politician? What's the lens?
I'd probably call myself a parliamentarian.
Parliamentarian.
But that's been, okay, no. But that probably says quite a lot, actually, that that's how I think about myself. So, I don't know. It's kind of, because there are times which are really exciting in there. And there's times when it's really quite boring. And, that, you know, when you're in there at 3 o'clock in the morning and you've been in the building since 10 o'clock the day before, you know, you're not sitting there going, yay! But I think because I've had that life in sport, that it puts it into perspective that the moments I've got to bring about change could be few and far between.
How early on in your sporting career did you sense that the political career might, or the parliamentarian career might kick in?
According to my dad, which I can't quite remember this, he told me when I was 21 that I was going to end up in the House of Lords.
So he had a premonition.
Yeah, but I don't remember that at all. I think probably mid-20s.
Right.
I was thinking of more law, you know, more lawmaking. Well, it is lawmaking.
Yeah.
But sort of on the other side, sort of arguing for the legislation now, you know. So I've ended up in the sort of the space that I wanted to be in.
When you are sat on the organising committee of a major moment like the London 2012 Olympics, was that also an eye-opener in terms of actually, I suppose, you know, a lot of people say that the Olympics is quite a sort of almost a political world you're smiling, but I mean, it doesn't, you know, you're bidding, you're pitching, you know, that side of it must have been very interesting for the you that you were going to go on to become.
There's more politics in sport than in politics. Way more. Politics is quite, you know, sports politics is tough. It's never been an area, international sports politics, it's not for me.
Yeah,
it's fascinating when you dip in and out of it to see how it works.
And last question, I'm going to take an arbitrary moment. Your first medal, your bronze. If you could give advice to that person that stepped up to the podium today, what might you say to them, do you think?
You know, as an athlete, I was really passionate about duty care, supporting other athletes. Again, you know, once you start winning medals, you can be quite protective. And I saw a lot of athletes not treated that well because they weren't winning medals. So that's sort of a big part of my life then and my life now. I probably said enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever stopped to really enjoy it. You know, we'd come to the end of the games, end of a four-year cycle, I'd have 2.5 weeks off, I'd be back in training.
A lot of ambitious people are like that, though. They don't actually living in the moment is a very hard thing to do.
Never did it. Mm. But then actually that sort of made me good, because if I had longer off, I was someone who had an amount of natural talent, but had to train really hard. So, you know, I always had this sense of, it could be taken away from you at any moment. You could get injured, not selected, you know, yeah. just make the most of the time that you have.
But maybe enjoying the moments, the new ambition for Tanny Gray Thompson. I mean, that could be a...
I'll give it a go.
We'll give it a go. Tanny, thank you so much for joining me. We've been experiencing all four seasons in one interview, but we've also heard the story of a great life. Thank you very much for joining me on Changemakers.
Thank you.